Alafia Harambe listeners, you are now live at the 9 o'clock hour with your host, Baye Kemet, and the show is The Liberated Zone, and I have with me tonight my illustrious guest, my esteemed elder and a wonderful scholar in the African community, Dr. Joy DeGruy. Dr. Joy, are you with us?
I am with you. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you wonderfully.
Okay.
All right. Before we begin, Dr. DeGruy, I just want to give a few announcements that we normally give for our show. I want to, again, welcome all of our listeners tonight. I want to remind everyone that our Shule, our school here in Trenton, New Jersey, the Garvey School, you can find us at www.thegarveyschool.org. And we have a few events coming up here in the city of Trenton that we want to make people aware of. One, we are working feverishly to get Dr. DeGruy here in the city. And as soon as we can finalize everything and her schedule can permit, we will let you all know. We have, Dr. DeGruy, we have a list of people just waiting for us to break the news so they can come out and come and hear you speak here in the city of Trenton.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I look forward to it.
Ashe. And so we also have on December 5th, we have a magic show that our school is sponsoring. It's going to be at the Mill Hill Playhouse. It's going to be hopefully with the brother Randy Shine. We are finalizing which magician is going to be, but you know it's going to be a black magician. And very interestingly, in discussing magic, the profession of magicians and what have you, we had a magic class at our Shule last year and found out that the whole culture of magic here in America and throughout the world was actually started in ancient Africa, in the Nile Valley civilization. And brothers come in and they give the history of all of the magicians and down the line of what have you. So there's a very interesting history to it. But at the same time, we're going to present something for our babies in our community here in Trenton, New Jersey. And lastly, I want to remind everyone that the Council of Independent Black Institutions, of which I am co-facilitator along with Mama Riquette, is also still looking for members. You can find out more about the Council of Independent Black Institutions at www.cibi.org. That is www.cibi.org. You can be an individual member. You can be an institution, you can be an after-school program, you can be an African-centered program or school, store, or just, again, an individual or anyone who is committed to righteous living and sovereignty for African people. And moving in that vein, you can most certainly become a member of CB. All right? So without any further delay, I want to begin tonight with Dr. Joy DeGruy. Dr. DeGruy, I would... say to you, I've said to you on the phone, but I want to say to all our Harambe listeners that my wife and I are tremendous fans of your work. We, again, like I've told you before, we've read your book. We've recommended your book. I personally made your book mandatory reading when I teach at the community college here in Trenton. I shouldn't say this. I shouldn't say this to you, but I've copied parts of your book to disseminate so that we can discuss amongst people who couldn't purchase the book, but most certainly have promoted your work. And, again, sure. We are quite fond of your work, and I want to say thank you for all of the work that you've done for our community.
And I want to say thank you. I certainly could not have done the work without the support of the community and encouragement of the community and the trust of the community. I am merely a witness.
Ashe. All right, so let's begin. Dr. DeGruy, I want to start by asking you, just simply, how did you embark upon doing research and coming up with a book such as Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome?
Well, first of all, I want to say, and I think most of your listeners would bear me out, that was already there. I think it's in our cellular memory, if you will. It's always been with us. We've always known and carried this kind of knowledge with us, but we've been silenced. It's almost been like the big secret. And so for me, after reading, G. Woodson's The Miseducation of the Negro, Even Frederick Douglass and his assessments, looking at, of course, the esteemed work of Naima Akbar and Wade Noble. I mean, you know, you begin to look at all of those who have gone, John Henry Clark, the list goes on and on and on. There's no way that this is new. I think what happened for me is not so different than what has happened for many African Americans. I looked around to myself, I looked at my family, I looked at my neighborhood, I looked at my community, and I saw things even as a child that just didn't feel right for me. It didn't feel right that when someone was angry with me when I was young that they would call me black, which would precede any other remark that was negative. You black, whatever it is. You black.
Right.
And everything that seemed to be negative, or if someone wanted to hurt me, what they would yell at me, what they would project, was something about being African. And so those were things that resonated and injured me, you know, as a child. Why is it that my looking black or being black is somehow used to try to hurt me? And so as I got older, of course, and more in tune with what was going on, it became clear to me that this stuff that I was hearing was not just something that I experienced, but the generations that followed me continued to use. Up until present times, these became an issue that I started hearing, you know, people talking about, you said this, oh, she's pretty, she's light-skinned, and he's got good hair, and, you know, all the other things that have continued up to 09. I mean, it's still with us. And so I started to see that as something very, very distinctly different from Africans in Africa. You know, there was a woman I met when I was in South Africa. It was so amazing. This is a perfect example. This African woman who said to me that she had come to the States, and she would study. She was in the nursing program. And the last year of her study, which was a five-year program, she sent for her daughter and her mother.
Right.
So to be with her that last year, when they came, you know, her daughter was out playing, and she comes in after only being there a short while, crying and screaming, and she goes, "What's wrong?" She goes, "Mommy, mommy, they call me black, mommy, they call me black." And her mother looks at her like, "Okay, so, but why are you crying?" No, I'm saying, because she's looking at her going, "Well, y'all are black, so I'm trying to figure out what it is they said that caused you pain." And she says, and at the moment she realized what her daughter was experiencing, she understood what had happened to African Americans, and she called her mother up, said, "Come and get her and take her home."
Right.
And I said to this woman when she said this to me, I said, "The only difference between you and me is I had nowhere to send my daughter." She had to live here with that madness. And so, again, she said, "I wasn't going to let her spend a day of her life thinking there was something wrong about her blackness."
Right, right.
So these were the things that prompted me to begin to look at this as anyone would their people. Look at it historically. Look at that in terms of adaptation. Look at that in terms of how we have embedded these beliefs within our what we call cultural. And what of those things we need to start extricating from our lives? So that is what it was. Those things were the things that caused me to look and look deeply. And again, you know, this is not new business of looking. It's not new. People have been looking at historical trauma. I mean, we've been looking at Holocaust how long?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
How long have we been looking at that? You know, and we can, and it continues to be a source of research and study for the Jewish community. In addition to that, you have indigenous people who are beginning to look at the impact and have for a long time looked at the impact of colonialism on them. You look at Aboriginal folk in Australia doing similar things. You're looking at individuals who have been in war-torn countries in Israel and Palestine. You're looking at people saying, what is the impact of these traumas upon our people? It just seems to me that looking at the African diaspora and looking at what has happened to African people, somehow the moment we get there, everybody wants to call, you know, hold up and go, no, you don't get to look, or why are you looking, or to give that up. But no one says that to anyone else.
Right.
No one tells them not to look. How dare you tell me I can't?
Right. It's a long time ago. That is past or something to that effect. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm going, you know, again, if we were to have, someone asked me recently on a talk show, they said, well, Joy, if after the period of enslavement, the whole idea of the, you know, the equal acceptance, if the playing field truly had been leveled, if that enslavement period of trauma, hundreds of centuries of trauma, was not then followed by more trauma, but instead something that really did inculcate those words, send us your poor, your tired, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. If, in fact, America had embraced its African people in the same way that it had welcomed others to its shores, would we still have the same issues we have now? I said, of course not. I said, if the liberty and justice and truth and, you know, the pursuit of happiness had been something readily available without Jim Crow and convict lease and lynch mobs and the Klan, had that happened, there would have been a really good chance to have not continued to be injured and re-injured by the racism in this country. So surely we would have been able to, but the amazing thing is we've done as much as we've done without that help. So imagine how much more, which brings us to my work, we can get done if we start teasing out the crazy stuff.
You're right. I said. You're right. And, you know, I always remind my students that there would be no Marcus Garvey. There would be no Malcolm X. There would be no Civil Rights Movement, no Dr. King. There would be no Dr. Joy Leary or even your work if it were not for the protracted, you know, white supremacy and oppression and those kind of things that we've experienced in this country. So you're most certainly right.
Sure. You know, and so we have to understand that, you know, the amazing thing is that there's a certain level of strength that is gained through as much struggle and as much strife and trauma that we've experienced. There's been some incredible gains that we have made, but it has not been without tremendous cost. And those costs exist on a number of different levels. A clear one is literally the physical health and well-being of our people. Looking at the rates of incarceration and just general death, you're looking at these things that are continuing. And I think they're exacerbated, and this is what people have to understand, because people have a difficulty connecting that historical legacy, because there's an assumption, a mistaken assumption, a myth, that somehow after slavery, the playing field was in fact leveled, and, you know, why can't y'all just pull yourselves up from the bootstraps? That mentality.
Right. Right.
And yet one has to take a look at disproportionality on every single level. Disproportionate arrest, disproportionate police use of deadly force, disproportionate death, disproportionate illness, disproportionate poverty, disproportionate. I said, now wait a minute, that didn't just show up. Come on.
Right.
Do the math here. And so there is this tendency to want to say, well, no, everything's been fine. Well, tell me when. Tell
right.
me when. So what happens here is that as we move and people don't make those connections, then we have something that came out most recently, and I would ask any listeners to go online and look at it if they have not, and look very closely at the recent apology from the House of Representatives, you know, and Congress. Look at those apologies and how they're worded. It's very clear. They're saying we did horrible stuff to you throughout slavery. We did horrible stuff to you after enslavement, and we are continuing to impact you today. I'm using their words. How is it
right.
they know and we don't? Black
yeah,
folks
right.
that are going, don't have nothing to do with me. And you got the federal government owning it. Not that they're going to do nothing about it, let's be clear. But at this point, because all of the covers are being pulled off, you can't deny it. You cannot, it is not plausible that what we are seeing now, exacerbated by current issues, now we ain't added crack. Okay, we have not added crack to that equation.
Right.
We've not added,
right.
you know, HIV and AIDS to that equation. We've not added, the absence of fathers and teen pregnancy to that equation. Are you following me? So I'm saying
yeah.
that this, all of what we're seeing now, is even further exacerbated by the contemporary social problems that everybody's facing.
That's right.
And so we end up getting confused about all that, and we begin to, you know, look at ourselves and even feel shame, anger, and antipathy towards one another. And that's the
I
sad
agree.
Part.
You're right. I agree. You know, it's interesting. You said something earlier about your upbringing. I was going to ask you about if I'm not mistaken, you grew up in South Central.
I did. Yes.
Yes. You know, and which I know that's an experience in itself. You know, much of us on the East Coast have learned about the experiences of South Central LA, of course, through the 80s and the 90s and the movies of Boys in the Hood and Don't Be a was Menace to Society.
Yeah.
I almost got tripped up. Don't Be a Menace. Menace to Society. And those kind of things. But but what I was going to say to you, Dr. DeGruy, you know, is that in comparison to some of the things that you talked about as being attacked in terms of being called black and those kind of things, I can recall here in New Jersey, in Trenton, growing up and having African children, Jamaican children, you know, other diasporic Africans in my neighborhood and us teasing them, you know, us calling them, you know, African booty scratcher, us calling them, all of the kinds of names that we could to try to make it seem as though they were different from us. We were better than them because we were born here in America, or we were somehow lighter or closer to the European than they were. And so that, you know, of course speaks to this whole concept of a post-traumatic slave syndrome. And can you please just speak to this notion of how this is playing out on our babies today through movies, through music, and things of that nature?
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up because I was talking to someone. There's, I don't know if you know who Tom Burrell is, but Tom Burrell is getting ready to come out with a pretty phenomenal book. And many others also are looking at the impact that media has played on these images and beliefs. Because it would seem like a lot of folks ago, but, you know, there was a point in the 40s, 50s where, you know, 60% of African-American households, even upward of 75% of them, were two-parented. And what happened? How is it we seemed to be doing better, and then it became a hot mess. And there's a couple of things that we have to take a look at. One, economics has played a horrific role in actually destroying a black community and just in general. If we were to take a look at media and look at media's role, you know, I remember my mother telling me, and both my parents are passed now, but if you look at people, I'm in my 50s. I'm 50. I'll be 50 next week, a couple weeks from now. So I'm in a different age group, but in my age group, you know, I remember my mother and my grandmother and them talking about listening to the radio. They didn't have a television.
Yeah, right. Right.
They talking about everybody would come and sit around and listen to the radio. You know, Amos and Andy and all these crazy stuff they would hear. But now consider that. Now, other than you sitting at that radio, your reality and your experience about blackness and black health and black value and black significance came from your experience. You lived in a community, you went to work, you went to school, you saw black people, you interacted. There was not this dominant message consistently being told to you in every shape and fashion that's telling you you were inferior, you were ignorant, you were violent, you were oversexed, you didn't get those, literally because they weren't even available to you. Now you can get them, you can get it Twittered to you. Are you following me?
Yeah, I do.
You can Twitter it, it's on television, it's on video, it's on, you know, it's on every level of technological communication available. And those messages are bombarding our young people with images of who they are that are negative, and that they are swallowing whole with no filter. And so I think that there's a combination of a disintegration, general moral disintegration in this country, coupled by a preponderance of information that's being blasted with images. I mean, just look at it. Look at the television. Look at what is permitted to be said and portrayed as it relates to black people. It's over and over again. A few people can get in there in the industry and begin to try to buffer that with some more positive images. But if you look at hip-hop, you look at, yeah, there's some real positive hip-hop, but come on, you listen to Lil Wayne. Come on. I remember hearing recently something that was on some lyrics, and I stopped and I went, wait a minute, I thought I heard, and I said, no, I didn't. Clearly, that couldn't be what was said. So my daughter went online and basically, because she could not and would not say the words to me, She printed them out, and I read them, and I was horrified by that. I was horrified by it. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, this is going unfiltered into the iPod. Are you with me? Which, with the little phone in the ear, not outside the ear, in the ear.
Right.
You see, and when you begin to look at what, if it bleeds, it bleeds. If it's lewd, if it's violent, if it's vulgar, then it sells. And this is what is consistently being placed in the media. Right now, I know folks that are in the film industry that are saying to me, they said, you know, we've been wanting to put some quality shows on, but quality shows cost money, and then you got to pay writers. And since they don't want to do that, they're coming up with reality TV. And the reality TV should get even more outrageous in order to top the one before it. So let me give you some perspective on that. Let me give you some perspective. I went to a conference on violence against women in New York. And this little guy shows up. He's got to be like early 30s, white man, maybe about 5'7", in a suit, quiet. His talk is on pornography, right? So when he speaks, this is what was so amazing about it. This man had been injured by his own work. He said that when he set out to do this documentary on the impact of pornography, he had no the man literally, he never showed a single picture. All he did was talk and talk about what he learned and the things people showed him and said to him. And he said, all I want you to think about right now for you to understand how bad it's become is look at late night TV. You know, what is it, the late night uncut stuff that's on television. He says, regular television. He says, you just go on, you stay up late enough, you'll see some crazy stuff. He says, now, I want you to consider that that's what you can see without any censorship. Consider what the pornography industry has to do to top that. Now you know how degraded human beings are becoming. So you see what I'm saying? It's like we are sinking to ever lower depths of our humanity, and our children are caught in the crossfire of this.
Well, certainly, and it's marketed to our children. I mean, you know, it's marketed. Unfortunately, it's marketed to them. You know, quite often, my wife and I riding down the street in the car. You know, even in the morning sometimes, and I mean, it's not to bash Steve Harvey, but there's certain words that he'll allow himself to say, you know, damn or hell or, you know, and that's not even as pornographic or what have you, but when you get to later on in the day, especially at nighttime on radio, they can say all kind of things. There's certain songs, certain words that are filtered through now that are, they're pushing the limit more and more every year so that children can hear more. And it's becoming a part of the, you know, the deterioration, the destruction of our communities. You're most certainly right.
Children of color, in particular African American children, you know, you look at, we are disproportionately exposed to some to that negative behavior on a lot of different levels. The being, you know, who's minding the store? You know, if Mama is 14, let's just do the math. If Mama is 14, who is watching me and what I'm watching on TV? Mama's probably sitting there with me watching it, okay?
You're right.
And so you're beginning to see an attrition. In other words, these problems have major layers connected to them. And I am not one of those people that don't look at all, you know, the whole picture. There's a whole lot going on here. And one of the things that we do know will buttress a child and build resilience is a real clear sense of who they are. You know, this data, this is not something I'm making up. This is not just, you know, conjecture. We know now that the degree to which a child feels themselves healthy, whole, culturally, physically, spiritually, is the degree to which they can move through that, wallow through the sickness and maintain some level of health. But if you put those children out there with no tools to navigate that, no sense of dignity, no sense of worth, no sense of history, no sense of value, then what do you expect? We're creating, if we don't begin to look at this, you know, again, there's a statement that I say in the book and often in my lectures, I'm not who I think that I am, and I'm not who you think that I am. I am who I think you think that I am. That's how we arrive at our self-concept, based on the appraisals of significant people in our environment. And if mama and daddy and uncle and sister and cousin are saying you ain't going to never be nothing, your daddy wasn't nothing, your mama wasn't nothing, you ain't going to be nothing, come on. You know, and we have to understand, well, who are they and why are they saying that? And you cannot look at them outside of their environment and who raised them. And you can't look at that person and what they pass along outside of what was given them. I mean, it's not, this is not difficult to understand, but somewhere in here we got to interrupt the crazy. We got to interrupt the crazy and look beyond myself. Let me just say, in the next 2 days, I'm doing two interventions. One with a child that has threatened to commit suicide. This is a black child. The second intervention is with a little girl who's 15. They got folks crawling, boys crawling through her window at night. I'm getting ready to sit down with the family to teach them, to help them understand how do you do an intervention, because this is not okay. You see?
Right.
And so what we, but you have to understand, these ain't my kids. I've raised children. I have grandchildren. But those children are my children.
Right.
Those children are my children, too. And my daughter's going back to school to get her PhD so she can help children other than her own. So we have to recognize that if it takes the whole village to raise a child, it takes a whole village to sustain a family. A whole village. We all got to roll up our sleeves on this one.
I agree. My share. We are actually right at the midpoint. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to pick up the dialogue on the second half of the show. For anyone who wants to call in, maybe we can take a caller or two on the second half of the show. You can call in at 877-514-5454. You are listening to Dr. Joy DeGruy on the Liberated Zone here on Harambe Radio, and we will see you on the second part of the show.
Greetings, Harambe family. This is Samut A. Scott of Magical Mother. I'd like to introduce you to some friends of mine. Equity Source Home Loans, located right here in the North Brunswick, New Jersey area, have been servicing clients for more than 20 years. The office has hours Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the products they offer are conventional, FHA, VA, reverse mortgage, and assistance with investment and commercial property needs. Their number is 732-821-2110. And tell them Magical Mother sent you.
Respect the Root is the theme of the 15th annual International Locks Conference, Natural Hair, Holistic Health, and Beauty Expo, happening Saturday and Sunday, October 3rd and 4th, 2009, at the Walter D. Palmer Leadership Learning Partners Charter School, 910 North 6th Street in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. For further information, call toll-free 1-888-305-3186 or go to www.locksconference.com. That's LOCKSconference.com. Yes, it's time to get up, stand up, and come to the Locks Conference. It is definitely the place to be October 3rd and 4th in Philadelphia. Peace.
Peace and love. This is Samut of Magical Mother Coaching and Empowerment Services. Are you feeling stress and anxiety? Are you dealing with a life-changing circumstance or situation? Are you looking to improve your personal empowerment or your spiritual connection? At Magical Mother, we specialize in life skill and wellness coaching using the healing and spiritual arts such as meditation and yoga, qigong, and stress management techniques. You will also benefit from our publications, Mastering a Joyful Life, a holistic guide to stress management, and a full catalog of personal empowerment and inspirational CDs. Visit us on the World Wide Web at magicalmother.com, and remember, the power is in your hands.
This is Delani Amon, thanking you for listening to Harambe Radio. Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
All right, Harambe listeners, you are back at the second half of the show, Liberated Zone, with your host, Bayan Kimmett. And tonight, as my guest, I have Dr. Joy DeGruy, author of Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And the first half of the show, we were just discussing how Dr. DeGruy came about doing the research for her work and discussing how this syndrome, this notion of our people not being where they should be because of the trials and tribulations and things that we've been through in relation to slavery, enslavement, and the protracted enslavement that has happened to our people, not only here in America, but throughout the world. And so this part of the show, the second half, we want to discuss a little bit about how this post-traumatic slave syndrome is affecting our children in the American public school system. When I say American public school system, of course I'm including charter schools. And Dr. DeGruy, I'm sure you haven't listened to the show, but we quite frequently try to make a distinction between independent schools and charter schools and public schools. And charter schools are public schools, but, you know, there's been some debate and some dialogue and discussion about African-centered charter schools. And sometimes people confuse that with African-centered independent schools and thinking that they're both fully African-centered, but that's a discussion for another time. But so, and at the end, some between now and the end of the show, we want to work our way towards a solution and some reachable solutions and resolutions that we can come to confront this issue. So I'm going to ask you, Dr. DeGruy, can you please speak to how this is affecting our children in the public school setting?
I think that part of what's happening in education right now is that we are finding it is seeming exceedingly difficult to actually find a mature mind coming out of our educational system. And part of it is antiquated. It's antiquated in general. And the other part of it is that there is more and more they're actually taking out these systems of education, anything that speaks to the contribution of Africans and people of African descent to this country. And, I mean, you know, sometimes people look at it as black history. And that's ridiculous. Black people have contributed to every level of learning, every branch of knowledge. We have contributed in this country and around the world. We needn't reach back to, and although it's relevant and real to Egypt, we can look at contemporary contributions which have never been brought forth or spoken about in classrooms throughout the United States. It's as if there's been no contribution, not just of black people, but anybody. And so what's ending up happening is who we are as a people is being trivialized as, you know, what I call the feast and festival. It's a feast and festival. Oh, yeah, yeah, let's have some music. Let's have some people dress up in garb. Let's have some folks bring some ethnic food and let's celebrate diversity.
Right.
I'm sorry, we built the country. Okay,
right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
So there is this denial. One, and one of the first aspects of my the study, I just finished the study guide, which is available on my website right now, and I'm getting ready to do a. Presenting the study guide for the first time in Los Angeles on October 17th to really begin to talk to people about how do you work through this. But one of the first steps towards healing or even the first steps towards fixing a floundering educational system is to tell the truth. You have to start telling the truth. I mean, it's no deeper than that. Let's tell the truth. And the
right.
truth has not been told. And because the truth has not been told for so long, everyone wants to pretend as though, you know, there's just some additional. No, we're talking about basic truth, stuff that is not obscure. Let's just fold it back in. Let's fold in the truth of the economic foundations of this country. Let's talk about the contribution of those who built this country. Let's talk about the importance of culture and psychological well-being of all people. Let's talk about that and put it in a context that is not separate, but very, very much integrated into all other branches of knowledge. Because we have contributed on all branches of knowledge. So you see, it's almost as though we are, by virtue of isolating this information, as though it's something separate, we're almost saying, well, it has no value outside of some cultural expression. No, it is the reality, the bedrock, the foundation of civilization itself. What do you mean?
Right.
I don't care what classroom you're in. I'm not talking about history class. You tell me you're in a science class, you're in a biology class, you're in an English class, you're in a sociology class, you're in a social studies class. It should be there because it is there.
That's right.
It's just simply left out. So when I think about what's going on in school, we're learning about stuff that has no relevance to surviving in today's society. You have children black, white, cross the board, are walking out going, what am I going to do with this stuff? What value does it have to me in terms of me walking through this life successfully and healthily? What is what I'm learning? How can I apply directly what I am learning to my experience? It's almost as though, you know, as in the news people say, you know, there's a 45% chance of rain, and you look outside and it's raining. That means there's a 100% chance of rain. Okay? Why? You know, I'm sorry, it's raining. At this
point.
And so we do is, and what I'm seeing is happening to education across the board. You have one, the people who are put in front of children, I think it's a rule that they just have to not like children. It just must be the rule. That the people, especially the first people you walk in that's at the front desk, they hate children.
Right. That's right.
They hate them. And we can't seem to get them out. These children assault children, these teachers and these administrators assault children. It's almost like I've looked at, been on review boards, we've looked at the process of police officers being hired. You need to look at anybody who has openly decided I want to have a gun and walk around and deal with crime. We need to look really closely at someone. And you know what else? We need to look really closely at people we put in classrooms with our children. And I don't care who they are. You have black children with black teachers who despise them more than any other white teacher could.
Right.
These are black teachers, okay? Because these are black teachers who are injured, who don't like who they are. So they certainly don't like these black children in front of them.
You're right.
And again, we, you know, if you look at most of the research around education, a huge percentage of it, something like 90% of the success is attributed to the teacher.
You're right.
So this is not, you know, no difficult math either. Let's look at the teachers and look at who's being hired. Some teachers, particularly in urban settings, aren't even credentialed. Aren't even teaching in an area for which they have any expertise. Because that is the way of so many urban schools that are going under, is that we're just saying we'll put anybody in front of them.
That's right.
And that's what's happening. If you have a person themselves that does not value the children in front of them, I mean, they did this, back in the 60s? Late bloomers theory? They took and gave teachers these fictitious folders on a group of children. And in the folders it said, okay, this child is a fast learner. This child is a late bloomer. It's called, you know, so he's not going to, he just has a lot of trouble. This student here is just very, very creative. And guess what? The children became the folder. What the teacher believed the child was is what they produced.
Right.
And so what we have to understand, and this is not deep, you know, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. What is it that you believe? Your thoughts become your reality. These are things we know. And so if you have people that are in front of children that don't believe them capable, some of them, and like I said, I don't care what the teacher looks like. If that teacher looks across at this person and does not believe they have potential, they don't have ability, they don't have genius, then they are already on their way to becoming fodder criminal system. My teacher told me, I graduated from Crenshaw High School, which is probably about to lose its accreditation. I graduated from Crenshaw High School. Crenshaw was brand new at the time. It was a new school, but it already got the name shortly after opening as being Fort Crenshaw. Fort Crenshaw is what they called it, because the police were there every single day. There was never a day I went to school the police were not there. And so we had this mentality, we were in, you know, it was just like a war zone. So my guidance counselor, now I'm in high school, my guidance counselor said to me, "You are not college material." This is my advisor, right? My guidance counselor said to me, "You are not college material." This is a middle-aged white woman who looked at me with absolute disgust, right?
I heard the same thing. I believe it.
But imagine, and here's the reality. Like I tell people in my lectures, I wish she had lived long enough for me to go back and blow her hair back. But she didn't. She died. But she shouldn't have been there. She should never have been there because she didn't impact me. Because when I went home, my family laughed out loud. They just laughed out loud. But there were plenty of young people that went home to families where maybe they were going to be the first one to ever go to college. Do you see? And so there wasn't that encouragement. There wasn't that thing to buttress them, to secure them, to build them. It wasn't. So maybe they believed that crazy woman. They really believed they weren't college material. And I never believed it, not for a second. But there were plenty who weren't like me. And I don't know how many there were or who they were, but I know that she should never have been there.
Right.
And yet, you know, these are things that have gone on. I mean, literally for generations, we've had these crazy people in our schools teaching our children and or curriculum that doesn't make sense.
Right.
You see, so I think that these don't have to be opposing things. For example, what does culture, for example, let me give you something. I was invited to speak at the University of Wisconsin. And one of the things that happened was I was actually being called in. Dr. Edwin Nichols was there and had done some work with their science department. And the science department was basically claiming, well, culture has nothing to do with science. Science is science. You know, math is math. There's just no reason why there's no value to culture. And I'm going, culture is what law gave you your science, but I'm going to let you have that.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to let you go and walk with that one now because you can't. That's ridiculous. It's a foolish thing to even say. But let's just move on. So I fly in most of white males, middle-aged and above, older, who are saying, what is the value you talking to us about being African-American? So I said, I wanted to submit something to you. I said, what are you teaching right now? They said, well, this one professor raised his hand, so we're going to take a break. I said, but I want you to consider how you could fold in something that's culturally, environmentally relevant to the young people you're dealing with and the lesson plan you're giving them. They were talking about space, volume, time. These were basically the scientific things that they were looking at, right? So I said, how can you teach that? I want you to go back, and I want you to consider what you're teaching. I want you to teach anything different. I want you to teach it, though, folding in something that you see in this environment that the people who come to this school can relate to, that are of African descent. These people came back. It was as though they had never thought out of the box in their lives. They were so excited they didn't know what to do. This one man came out. He put the chart on the wall. He said, I consider the one thing I know they do, they play basketball after school all the time. So I made the basketball court the actual word problem. And then I talked to them about space, the ball, volume, speed, all of those things. I taught the exact same curriculum. He says, and I could do it using something that I just see them do every day in play, that they can relate to, connect. And then each one of them, based on the curriculum, said, well, you know, I can fold into this historical context as it relates. I mean, each one of them came forward and said, we just never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
We just never thought about it. It's not about the curriculum. Nobody's asking you to dumb it down or do something different, but just think out the box because everything is not a European paradigm. I did things with children. I did things with children as young as I went to a preschool. So in this preschool, because I wrote a model called the relationship model, where basically the model got tested and it was found to be effective. And I'll be happy to put it online and give it to people. But I knew it would work because I knew what influenced and what inspired black children. I was a black child, too. So here's what happens. Let's look at kindergarten. Start with kindergarten. So you have these little kids, and they come in. And, you know, nowadays, well, they probably come in, they got cell phones and been working on computers. My 4-year-old granddaughter, she's not even 4 years, she's 3, asked me to come and turn something. I couldn't even do it. Not only could she turn it on, but she knew the game. Amazing. She's 3. So I'm saying what they're able to do now is phenomenal. But so it's not a question of that. But let's imagine how teachers inspire children. Okay, so you come across this classroom, the teacher goes, okay, we have all of these things that we have to do today. We're going to have math time. We're going to have play time. We're going to have snack time. We're going to have seat work, all these different things. Now, if you do all your seat work, and the teacher puts up a chart, and on the chart, every child's name is on the chart. And it says if you do all of your seat work, this is your incentive to do your seat work. I'm going to give you a star. So the teacher says, here's Shaquisha. Shaquisha, you do all your work, I'm going to give you a star. Treviante, you do all your work, I'm going to give you a star. So day one, they do all the seat work, they get the star, they go, ooh, ooh, I got a star. Day two, they said, now we're going to get a little smiley face, a little sticker with a smiley face. Ooh, 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 I got a smiley face. Next time, you know, it's a little apple. And then about the fourth day, the black children are going, I can make my own star. I'm not going to do that for a star. A star is an object. And my assumption is you'll work for the object. And what I learned about black children, this is not rocket science, and I don't care, then and now, when you ask a black child, and Latino children too, you ask the Latino children, the Hispanic children, the same thing. You say, okay, you came home with a C or a minus or whatever the little thing is they give you, and you ask that child, why did you get this poor grade? They will say to you, it is because my teacher doesn't like me.
That's right.
And my teacher doesn't like me. We've heard that for generations, have we not?
That's right.
So guess what? How about we believe them? Because what they're saying to you, whether it's true or not, is I need to believe my teacher likes me. Because we are a relationship-based culture, not an object-based one. So what ends up happening is I look at Shaquisha, same child, I wanted to do the same seat work. Here's how I differ from the star. I put the star up there. That'd be great. But I look at Shaquisha and say, come here. Come here. I put my arm around her. I said, look at me.
That's right.
You know I got you. You know I know you can do it. Don't disappoint me now. Now, what am I making her understand? That I have an expectation of her and that I'm going
to be
with her. And guess what I found out? Felicia, Treviante, Jose, Maria will work for that faster and more consistently than they will work for a star, a C, a B, or an A. Now, evidence of that, if anybody wants to question me, look at what the Black in America series that came out. There's a brother on there that had a 100% graduation rate on to college. And if you were to ask, central most important element of that whole thing, I'm going to tell you it was him. It was because he loved them. It's because he was there for them. Because he believed in them. And he showed up every single day. That is a relationship-based approach.
That's right.
Period. Again, this is not, these things are not, again, we've not valued them. When you look out there in the empirical data age, it has not valued our cultural systems. Do you see? Not only is it an effective system, it's culture-based, and which gets poo-pooed. And, oh, well, there's nothing empirical about that. There's everything empirical about that. You look at any program across this country, any program that's successful working in inner cities or urban settings with children of color, and I'm going to guarantee you on the air that there is the relationship of the individuals providing that education and the students receiving it. It's the relationship itself becomes the linchpin that holds everything else together.
Mm.
And that is cultural. Cultural. Not magic, just real. That's
yeah,
why
right.
We say, I feel you. All that, think about all that stuff. I'm not feeling that. Or when you walk when I was growing up, it was like, man, you could, this is the vibe in here is so deep, you could cut it with a knife. These are all things that are non-physical, tactile, but it's real, you see, because it's how we navigate and move through the world, what I feel from you. And why do we negate the significance of what I feel? You can't do that if you
want to
raise children. You can't.
I want to add, Dr. Joy, with the relationship, I also tell my students that the way that we speak as African people is a connection to family and a connection to relationship, as you're saying. So we say, peace, family. What's up, cousin? Well, hey, mom.
That's right.
What's up, uncle? What's up, mom? What's up, dad? hey, you know, so all of our the way that we speak to each other is based on family. I feel
That's
you.
Right.
I see you. You know what I'm saying? You know, we say those kind of things because we are connecting to each other on a wavelength that Europeans don't understand.
That's right. That's right. I got you. I got your back.
Right.
You know, you look at all of those things, and you look at how we've survived, and each time, each generation has its own colloquialisms. We have its own way of doing it, but it all folds back into a sense of kinship. Sometimes it's called fictive kinship. You know, when we have, again, if you go to Africa, particularly West Africa, you'll find that, you know, people who are actually your cousins, you know, or your aunts are called mothers.
Right.
And your uncles are your dads. And your cousins are your sisters and brothers. Right. So it's not, that notion of kinship is very strong, and it is carried over. And so we negate it. We try to pull it out because we are navigating based on a monocultural, largely Northern European construct of reality, and we've decided that if it doesn't fit within that very narrow construct, out of which even white children aren't doing well, you know, then there's something wrong with it, or somehow it is less valued. And I just don't believe that. I just don't believe it. I was one of those children. I have, like, I don't know, if I got 4 degrees, and I'm saying that I'm not one of those people particularly like school, but I'm one of those folks that has a keen desire for learning. And I know that for me, it wasn't easy because I think differently. I also write differently. And so part of what happened was that when I was going through school, Joy, the little girl in the back, always needed the fourth explanation. The first one I didn't hear at all because I was scared.
Right.
Second one, I got part of it, and I got a little something in my head that said, I think I might understand it. The third one, I got half of it, and I felt good about it. And the fourth one, I got the whole thing. But how many students were going to raise their hand that fourth time? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I wasn't stupid. I wasn't unmotivated. I wasn't slow. I had a different way of conceptualizing things in my head, but I needed that fourth answer. I really did. And there's nothing wrong with that. And thank goodness I had enough in me that said, you know what, I may have got a little scared and people might laugh at me because I needed that fourth explanation, but you better believe I walked up to the teacher and said, could you share that with me one more time? Sometimes they would roll their eyes, but they'd give it to me, and that's how I made it.
That's right.
Because I was going to get it. But I don't know how many students who, you know, who might need that fourth explanation, that fourth description of it, is going to do that. Not today. Not in light of being feeling disrespected or being perceived as stupid or somehow remedial. You see, and our youth are fragile. Our people are fragile.
Right.
You know, and that's why I'm very, very careful about even when I'm, you know, I got to do two interventions that are very sensitive, but I do know that the interventions need to happen. We need to get up in the room and get up close and personal in order to move through, because we're talking about your life right now. We're talking about life and death. Now, so I'm not willing to go through the ignorance or the denial that the elephant's in the room. We're gonna pull out the elephant, and we're gonna talk about it. And that's part of what the answer is too. Part of the answer is we need to start telling the truth. We need to start talking about this stuff. We need to start with not stop holding the secrets, because the secrets are making us sick, and it's making our children sick. So my study guide, by the way, speaks to this. It speaks to the whole idea of. How do you actually navigate through this? How does one assess oneself, one's motives, and one's beliefs and thinking?
And what is your website, please, so people can know where to go to get their web?
Joy. It's Joy DeGruy, DeGruy.com. JoyDeGruy.com. And I have a blog on there. I try to pass along information that as I learn it. I put it on my website. I try to share different books, different information. Again, we have to begin to reach out and to communicate with one another, and we need to help. The study guide is, again, it's a way to operationalize the post-traumatic, the book, and understand how one can apply it to oneself, one's family, one's community.
Oh, man, yes. We'll definitely be purchasing the book and definitely trying to, you know, promoting the book and promoting the website and what have you. We have about 4 minutes left. I was just going to briefly say that of all of the profound things you said tonight, one of the ones that I wanted to touch on very quickly was the concept of the curriculum, you know, not addressing the experiences and then the present-day concerns and necessities of our people. You know, Baba Ajay Okoto always says that the teacher is the curriculum. Too
That's
often
right.
we are looking for a document or some kind of external, you know, apparatus to help us in the classroom, but people don't understand that when that woman, that EI, that mama walks in the classroom with her gele on or her lapa and her African clothes or whatever, how her dress is, she's bringing the curriculum, she's bringing her experiences in the classroom. And the way in which she teaches and the way that she interacts with those students is the curriculum. You know, and so today, you know, our schools, most of the public schools and charter schools are geared towards math, science, language arts, social studies, accounting, and those kind of things. But the most profound thing you said is that our students cannot take that and go home and solve the problems with HIV and AIDS, with, you know, with alcohol abuse, with crack addiction, with all of the things that they're confronting in the society. Even graduation, you know, seniors that are graduating, they're coming out of high school knowing how to do math, knowing how to do science, but they don't know how to catch a bus. Or they don't know how to dress properly for a job interview. Or they don't even know how to connect with other African people. And they don't even know that they're even supposed to parlay their intellectual, what they've learned in school, to the community.
Exactly.
They are already been placed on this assembly line, and they are prepared to what? Go work for somebody else's community and parlay their wealth and their intellectual wealth to somebody else. So I just wanted to say that to add on to what you were saying, Mom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can't, you know, I couldn't stress that enough. And these are our brain trusts. These are our resources for our future, and we have to reach to them. And a lot of folks will say, well, that's not my problem. That's not my issue. But we have to look at the reality of what we're dealing with, roll our sleeves up, and get on board. And if you don't want to do it, you don't want to help, just get out the way.
That's it.
Bottom line.
All right. We have to end. We have to close out now. Again, please, can you give everyone your website again, and just so they can get in contact with you?
Absolutely. It's joydegru.com. JoyDeGrui.com.
All right. And, Mama, we
All
definitely
right.
have to get you back on the show again so we can discuss those solutions and, you know, so black people can find out some of the strategy that we can use to get ourselves out of this situation that we're in right now.
Absolutely.
Again, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, Dr. DeGru, and everyone, you are listening to the Liberated Zone here on Harambe Radio. I want to thank my esteemed elder and scholar, Dr. Joy DeGru, for coming on the show tonight. And hopefully we can get you on again.
All right. You know it's true. Okay. Take care.
All right. All right. Take care. Ashe.
Ashe.
Harambe family, this is Samut A. Scott of Magical Mother. I'd like to introduce you to some friends of mine. Equity Source Home Loans, located right here in the North Brunswick, New Jersey area, have been servicing clients for more than 20 years. The office has hours Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the products they offer are conventional, FHA, VA, reverse mortgage, and assistance with investment and commercial property needs. Their number is 732-821-2110, and tell them Magical Mother sent you.
Respect the Root is the theme of the 15th Annual International Locks Conference Natural Hair, Holistic Health, and Beauty Expo, happening Saturday and Sunday, October 3rd and 4th, 2009, at the Walter D. Palmer Leadership Learning Partners Charter School, 910 North 6th Street in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. For further information, call toll-free 1-888-305-3186, or go to www.lockconference.com. That's L-O-C-K-S conference.com. Yes, it's time to get up, stand up, and come to the Locks Conference. It is definitely the place to be October 3rd and 4th in Philadelphia. Peace.
Peace and love. This is Samut of Magical Mother Coaching and Empowerment Services. Are you feeling stress and anxiety? Are you dealing with a life-changing circumstance or situation? Are you looking to improve your personal empowerment or your spiritual connection? At Magical Mother, we specialize in life skill and wellness coaching using the healing and spiritual arts such as meditation and yoga, qigong, and stress management techniques. You will also benefit from our publications, Mastering a Joyful Life, A Holistic Guide to Stress Management, and a full catalog of personal empowerment and inspirational CDs. Visit us on the World Wide Web at MagicalMother.com, and remember, the power is in your hands.
This is Delania.